Recognized, Uncle Walker, D-0-1. Recognized, Emily of Arden, D-1-2.
Hello team, thanks for joining us for episode 7 of Whelm, The Young Justice Files Season 2. Welcome to the cave, my name is Rich, and I am here with my, not a sidekick, Emily.
Hey everybody.
As many of you know, Caleb is now a member of the Justice League proper. What could go wrong?
Don't say that! Everything could go wrong, Rich. Everything.
Sure, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. If you would like to get in touch with us, you can find us on Twitter at the YJ Files, on Facebook at Crashing the Mode, on our website, crashingthemode.com, on the YJFiles.tumblr.com, and at our email address, whelmedpodcast@gmail.com.
I take it our ruse was successful.
Almost too successful. The team and the league are in mourning. They may never forgive us.
And still, only we four know the secret?
This secret and the other. That you've been under deep cover within Black Manta's organization since leaving the team. How'd it go on that end?
Successful as well. I've proven my loyalty to my biological father. He is moving me up the ladder, bringing me closer to the light. And their unknown partner.
Not without cost, Calder.
And with that housekeeping out of the way, let's dive in.
To Hello, Megan.
Hello, Megan.
This week's episode is entitled Depths. The release date was June 9th, 2012, just 1 week after June 2nd, 2012 for the previous episode. But don't worry, a hiatus is coming. We've been going along
for a
real long time.
I've been
what
missing
would
the
Young
hiatuses?
Justice fandom be without our hiatuses? So don't worry, it's just around the corner. In episode, our dates are March 19th and 20th, and our director is Tim DeVar, and we have two writers for this episode, Kevin Hopps and Paul Giacopo. That's how I'm going to say it.
Ooh, that was good. That seemed like it was a good one. Special guest voices on this episode, Tim Curry, of course, the amazing, amazing Tim Curry as G. Gordon Godfrey. We have Kevin Michael Richardson, you know, doing most of the roles that he normally does, but he also does Thomas Kalmaku, who I will talk about a little bit later. And then we also have Kari Walgren as Carol Ferris as well.
That name sounds familiar. Maybe I'm just crazy.
She did some other voice work too on Wolf's Rain, actually, which is a great anime.
Oh my God. Is she that in? Yep. That's how I know her. She played Charmcaster in Ben 10. And as we know, I had a Ben 10 phase.
Oh, you
while.
Know what? She was also... So I've told you about the Legion of Superheroes animated
yep.
series that I was watching. And of course, I'm a big Legion fan. There's two seasons of that. But I was actually talking to Brandon Vietti, who directed some of the episodes. And he said that second season got really tight on funding. And so he was like directing two episodes at a time. And they were writing like two episodes at a time. Like they were doing everything in doubles. They were the producer was producing two episodes like literally right on top of each other. Well, it turns out she did three of the voices of main characters in that show. Like Saturn Girl and Triplicate Girl were both in almost every episode, and she was doing both those voices, and she did Shrinking Violet, who showed up in probably, you know, five or six of them as well. So she was in Kim Possible.
Who was she in Kim Possible?
In Kim Possible, she was Electronique.
Okay.
One of the bad guys, I'm assuming. Yeah, she's in a ton of stuff. Oh, she also did the voice of Black Canary and Elastigirl in the DC Nation shorts and stuff. So, all right. That was a really long voice acting segment.
Now that I'm thinking more about it, I'm like, her Carol Ferris voice sounds a lot like her Charmcaster voice, and I can't believe I didn't pick up on it earlier. It's because Carol Ferris doesn't yell as much.
Oh, nice. She looks familiar, too. Like, she's definitely been in some live-action work as well. Anyway, enough of that. Let's get on to this mission briefing.
Just in time for your next mission.
In our pre-credit scene, we are back at Wally and Artemis's little apartment, where Artemis is packed and ready to head out on a mission. Wally is not happy about this situation since he and Artemis are trying to retire, but Artemis insists that right now she's needed. They share a kiss, and Artemis asks the one question that never ends well, what could go wrong? We then have a hard cut to Nightwing giving Artemis CPR on a beach later that night before announcing that she's dead. That's not stressful at all.
That's not okay. We go back in time a bit to the afternoon before the shocking reveal of death and carnage. At Mount Justice, Nightwing reveals that there's been no progress on identifying the Light's partner. McGann and Lagan enter the scene, but Lagoon Boy's immaturity is cut short by the arrival of Artemis. We have a bit of an original team reunion before Nightwing briefs everyone on the upcoming mission, which is protecting a satellite being launched from anyone who might try to sabotage the launch.
Later at Cape Canaveral, Miss Martian takes part in a press conference disguised as Martian Manhunter. After answering a question from G. Gordon Godfrey, she flies off, shifts back into her normal form, and levitates Connor, who is currently dressed as Superman, back to the bioship. Whole complicated thing there.
Yeah.
While Lagan misses it, we see that underwater, a Manta sub deposits several troopers and an underwater base equipped with missile launchers on the ocean floor. Missiles pointed directly at the satellite.
With less than an hour left before the satellite is set to launch, Nightwing admits that he's missed having Artemis on the team. Of course, Nightwing has gone into the field for this one. While Artemis and Wally have been happy in retirement, she admits that she's missed the rush of the heroics and knows that's why Wally's probably a little bit worried about her getting out in the field, even though he just got in costume the week before. Nightwing even admits that, yeah, he's pretty familiar with the rush of being in the mask.
Then, over in the most awkward bioship ride ever, McGann calls Connor out on the silent treatment that's been going on between them lately, leading to a discussion of their breakup, the details of which have been pretty vague up until now. We learn that Connor apparently disapproves of how McGann's been, you know, ripping information from the minds of their enemies and leaving them basically brain dead. He's kind of not okay with that.
Yeah. Odd.
Just maybe a little. He hasn't told Nightwing or the League yet, though, because he thought that he could convince her to stop. But the breaking point in their relationship came when McGann attempted to make Connor forget that he was mad at her. He couldn't let that stand and thus broke off their relationship. And thus I cry.
Yeah, it's rough. I feel bad for Superboy. Meanwhile, Lagan disobeys orders by attacking that missile platform without waiting for backup. Artemis and Nightwing take on the Manta Troopers that are beginning to swarm the beaches, and Calder gives the Manta Troopers orders to fire on the rocket holding the satellite. Lagan is then captured and taken as a potential specimen for experiment for the Light's partner. Calder orders the troops to fire the rest of the missiles at the rocket while he takes the lead on the ground assault.
The fighting continues on all fronts, with Artemis almost being killed at least once before Calder steps foot onto the beach, which is a stressful scene.
So brutal, yeah.
Underwater, Miss Martian is ordered not to try and rescue Lagoon Boy, as stopping the missiles is the priority on this mission. She successfully destroys the missile platform, but the troopers escape with Lagan. Back on land, Nightwing and Artemis face off against Calder. The satellite launches, and while Calder tries one last attempt to finish his mission by launching his shoulder rocket that he just has, and it's cool, Artemis shoots it out of the sky.
So that provokes Calder to attack directly, knocking Nightwing aside and going after Artemis. After a brief confrontation, he stabs her through the chest, leaving her for dead. Amidst all the chaos, the satellite also, even though it's launched successfully, spontaneously combusts. Calder returns into the ocean with his Manta Troopers while we catch up with the pre-credit scene of Nightwing attempting to resuscitate her. McGann and Connor arrive on the scene, and despite Nightwing's best efforts, Artemis is pronounced dead. Back at their base, Manta congratulates Calder on a successful mission and reveals that it was all a test to see if that he would take credit for the satellite's destruction, because Black Manta had already planted a bomb ahead of time, just in case. Calder's honesty in the face of his failure and not taking credit for the bomb that blew up the satellite apparently proves him ready for the next level, being introduced to the Light. It's amazing how his honesty and his kindness and generosity has allowed him
murder.
To go to the next level. And murder.
Honesty, kindness, generosity, murder. These are the values we teach our children.
Yes. Welcome to the light.
Back at Mount Justice, everyone is mourning Artemis in a scene that gets me every time. While the other members of the team cry, Connor informs Mal that Nightwing is absent because he went to go tell Wally what happened. We then cut over to Bloodhaven, where Nightwing is alone in a warehouse contemplating that photo he took of himself and Artemis 5 years ago at Gotham Academy. However, his thoughts are interrupted by Calder, of all people, showing up. Before any sort of fight can break out, though, they are joined by Wally and Artemis. Through a flashback montage shot from different angles, we discover that Artemis's death was actually an elaborate ruse staged by Nightwing, Artemis, and Calder. Nightwing also reveals that only the four people present in this scene know that Artemis is alive, and that Calder is actually a double agent working undercover to discover the secrets of Black Manta's organization.
Yeah. Calder then tells the others that he is successfully moving up the ranks, but Nightwing points out that the destruction of the satellite and Lagan's capture were never part of the plan. Nightwing then sets the next stage of the plan in motion, which is giving Artemis a glamour charm that Nightwing acquired from Zatanna. To anyone other than the four of them, she now looks like an entirely different person, which allows her to go undercover alongside Calder, giving him backup, as well as a second set of eyes. Artemis and Wally share a touching goodbye before the two part. While Artemis and Calder board the Mantis sub, Wally and Dick watch from a distance, and Wally warns his best friend that it only gets more dangerous from here.
3 month hiatus.
Bam. Oh yeah, that's next.
That was so stressful, though. It's like we've set up this crazy situation, and it's like, and you don't get to know what happens for 3 months.
All right, Aster. Save it for the Aster.
Superboy, are you all right?
I'm fine. Feeling the Aster.
So there's some really cool small little background stuff. Aside from like how big this reveal is, they still take the time to put a bunch of stuff in the background. Of course, Ferris Air is who's responsible for launching this satellite, which is going to be a communication satellite between Mars and Earth, which is interesting to me because they keep reiterating the fact that the Martians are still alive. And in the comics, Martian Manhunter is typically one of the last ones alive of his people. So I'm wondering if they're going to keep going with this, particularly with all of this space invasion stuff. But we get to see Carol Ferris, who is the Hal Jordan Green Lantern's girlfriend. But while I was doing research on who the voice actors were for this episode, I also realized that they put in Thomas Komaku. And Thomas Komaku was a character introduced in the Green Lantern comics back in the 60s. Here he's an engineer, and back then he was also like a mechanic engineer that used to work on Hal's test planes. Like he was a test flight pilot back in the day. He's an Inuit Eskimo who used to go by the unfortunate name of Pie Face, which was really weird and strangely unnecessary, I think. But he was actually a pretty cool character and a pretty competent sidekick as opposed to some other sidekicks like, say, Jimmy Olsen and whatnot, who were always getting kidnapped or captured or mutated or whatever. At least that's how I remember him. So.
And if you were watching Green Lantern, the animated series, which was going on at the same time as Young Justice, you already knew who Carol Ferris was because she plays a decent supporting role in that show, despite most of it being set in space. She shows up every now and then, which is really cool.
Yeah, sometimes she becomes a villain in Hal Jordan's life. I don't remember seeing Thomas in that series. I have to go rewatch it. It's been a while. But I don't think he's in that one. So, but I like the other little things too, like the Merfolk McGann.
I love that.
I always love that. I love how she adapts to the aquatic environments. And we get to see her later on where they're pretty deep underwater and her whole body compresses because of the pressure. And I just, you know, being an aquatic gaming fan, like, I like how they take some of these things into account. So it's really cool.
It starts in the comics, too, is I think the first time that she does it, where her and Connor visit Atlantis and she meets.
Oh, yeah.
I'm forgetting what her name is, but it's the mermaid girl whose name is two L's. And I'm blanking on her name.
Lori Lemuris.
Yes, that one. She meets her and is just like, that looks cool. I can do that. And then she's just like, when I'm underwater, I'm going to be a mermaid from now on because nothing is stopping me.
Because why not?
So that's always really fun.
Yeah. Everything else in this episode, though, is pretty heavy. You have some notes on Lagan.
Don't I always have a few notes on Lagan? Because As we all know, I am not a big Lagan fan, and anyone who is, I'm glad you can like him. I can't. And so I just have a little thing about how he is so immature in this episode on so many levels, from like that opening scene of him just being like, if this isn't true love, I don't know what is, because he's just trying to make everybody around him annoyed. And there's no reason for him to say that.
And he looks, doesn't he like turn and look at Connor directly when he says
does.
That too? That
it's
actually, that's the part that makes it kind of extra jerky on that one, actually. That was unnecessary.
Though I do appreciate that when McGann just offhandedly is like, you need to slow down, you're going to choke, Superboy says, if only, and Nightwing smiles in the background because everybody's sick and tired of Lagan. It's just like, ugh.
I don't remember that. I have to look at it.
It's so much fun. With that scene and stuff, I feel like there is, you can try to make some comparison to how there is a scene in which McGann feeds Connor cake in an early season one episode in Cold Hearted. Be wow. Like, well, they did that then, so it's fine. And I'm like, yeah, but that's just them being cute and not deliberately trying to upset anyone. Connor isn't like looking directly at Wally being like, look at how she's not your girlfriend.
Right.
So exactly. It just annoys me. Lagan doing that annoys me. And he is so jealous in this episode too. That I just, ugh, I don't like it. It's just, he's so toxic. Whereas, like, if you compare how Connor interacts with Lagan and how Lagan interacts with Connor in this episode and in every episode, it's that Connor doesn't like Lagan. Connor doesn't like that McGann is dating Lagan, but he doesn't interfere and he doesn't, like, get overtly mad about it or, like, anything like that. Whereas Lagan doesn't even seem to trust McGann to be alone with Connor for 5 minutes during a mission. Mm-hmm. I'm like, you need to grow up and let your girlfriend do whatever your girlfriend's got to do, because you need to chill, fish boy.
Yeah. The only time he gets even a little bit like directly insulting to Lagan is when he calls him the newbie? The newbie
calls
forgot
him a
to
rookie.
Restock or whatever. Rookie. The rookie forgot to restock the rebreathers. Yeah.
And that sends Lagan into making bad choices and getting captured. There are consequences for being a jerk.
Yeah, I guess we do have another kind of relatively uplifting thing, I guess, which is just the fact that we get to see Artemis back with the team in costume and having everybody really excited to see her. Like, it's such a big jump from the first season where she's purposefully trying to keep everybody at arm's length for a long time and then kind of wondering if she's part of a team. And now she's not just a part of the team. She's actually a legend, you know, like a founding team member, and people look up to her, you know.
I love that. I love getting to see that. I love getting to see Artemis and McGann being friends, because they just get to hug and be happy that they're getting to hang out again. And everybody's so happy to see her. It's such a great little moment, because half of this season was being like, where is everybody we loved? And then this episode is like, she is right here. She is fighting crime again. Please calm down.
Yeah.
And I love that. And in that same scene, this rewatch, I finally picked up on something that had never really registered to me, where when they're talking about the satellite going up and everything, McGann looks genuinely really upset hearing like all about all of the stuff of people hating the idea of interacting with Mars. And it kind of finally like clicked in my mind that all of the xenophobic craziness that is encapsulated in this season is like personally affecting her, and she's like the only one on the team who it really affects, because she's the only one who's not from Earth. Like, Connor is a Kryptonian, but he was born here, I say in heavy quotation marks, whereas McGann is new to this planet, and hearing all of these different newscasters and all of these different politicians be like, we don't want aliens here, and she considers this place her home. I'm like, that is really hard, and that gets overshadowed by, you know, alien invasion
really
type stuff. But I was just like, oh, wow, that's a lot.
Yeah. I hadn't really thought about that. I have to go back and take a look at her reactions. Yeah. Because I guess it's kind of true. The other thing I was thinking of is the fact that she left Mars for a reason.
She did.
And we know that Martian Manhunter has sent back, you know, recordings of the things that he's doing. But in addition to that, like, Martians are seeing him being a hero on Earth, which means that now that she's, I guess she's still part of the team. She's not part of the league, so maybe she's still undercover. But like, if there's a reason why she's not there, you know, increasing communication with Mars, maybe she just doesn't want to go back, you know?
Yeah.
Like, maybe there's a reason she doesn't want to be known, you know? So it also makes me wonder if,
based on all of the hints that we get, her life on Earth is much better than her life was on Mars. So I can definitely see that playing yeah. into her decision and her emotions in this scene.
We know the bioship can go into space, but has she gone back to Mars ever? Does it, can it reach that far? Or is it more just a, you know, they say that she stowed away aboard Martian Manhunter's ship. What ship was he using? Like, does he have a Martian bioship somewhere? And if so, he can clearly go back and forth between there and Earth. So does she go back with it? Like, there's a lot of questions to be answered, and a lot of this xenophobia, like you're talking about, maybe affecting her.
There's one thing that I could say about that, but it ends up in crashing the mode because it's near the very end of the season.
Oh, let's bury that. Let's bring that in crashing the mode then. Let's do it.
Other things about this episode. The scene on the bioship with McGann and Connor that I gave the summary for, I just, when trying to write notes on this whole episode, I cannot fully articulate how emotional that scene is for me, and just in general. Y'all can chalk it up to me being a sappy shipper or whatever, but that scene is so well written and so well acted that I don't know how you get through that scene without feeling something. I'm pretty sure I cried the first time I watched it when I hadn't yeah. cried at anything in this series the first time through.
Yeah.
Because that moment of just hearing Connor break down and explain how much everything between them meant to him, and to have it fall apart like that is just so awful.
The whole, how could you not know that I would know your touch in my mind? Like, that's happened basically his entire life, you know? And then knowing what that meant to him, you know, and then have it perverted in that way, and like, it's just so brutal. And this is where we've talked about in Crashing the Moe before, like, even if their relationship, their friendship becomes repaired, I don't know if I want them to be back together. What she did was not okay, you know? Like, how do you build trust back up with someone like that, you know?
I don't know. And yeah. all of that, even her just, the voice act, just Nolan North and Danica McKellar are phenomenal in this scene of, because so much of Superboy is being angry or being tough or being just sarcastic a lot in this season because he's so sick and tired of other people making bad choices. Yeah. That in this scene, when you hear him so softly and so quietly be like, how could you not know I would recognize that? How could you not even think that? And her just being like, I'm sorry, I've told you I was sorry, is just, yeah. it hurts my soul. And it also is a great scene of hearing both of their perspectives on what she's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have heard a little bit from Connor about, he's like, you shouldn't be doing this, you shouldn't be doing this. But hearing her explanation as to why, I think, is also kind of important. Just hearing both sides of that argument, because she makes a point that what she's doing is helping a lot of people.
Yeah.
May not be right, causing a lot of harm too, but at the same time, she yeah. is helping the entire world not get killed by aliens.
Yeah.
Because this show brings up those difficult questions and what, and both of them have a point mm-hmm. in this scene. When talking about that, I feel like there is no right and wrong in that exactly. There are, yeah. both sides are so gray for that part of the conversation. When it gets into what she did with Connor's mind, that's a different
story. Yeah, directly,
story,
that's where across the line, yeah. There's so many, like, and of course, like, Connor and McGann's dynamic is pretty brutal, but they're not the only ones, right? That, I mean, this whole thing with Artemis, you know, quote-unquote dying, and like, we know that that was faked now, and but it's still harsh. But then on top of that, even little stuff, like Dick acknowledging to Calder about, look, there's been costs, right, to doing what we're doing, including the fact that Calder has to walk around the rest of his life knowing that an island full of living sentient creatures died you know, because of the actions he took or didn't take, you know, as in not telling the Kroletaeans that there was a bomb, you know, or whatever it happened to be. Like, and he's going to have to make decisions here in the not too far future here that are going to be things he's going to have to live with, you know?
Yeah. It's intense, and there are always consequences.
There are consequences.
The show shied away from there are always consequences.
Yeah.
And speaking of consequences, the scene after Artemis's death, faked death, in which they show everybody in the cave mourning, hits me so hard every time I watch it. It hits me harder than Artemis dying, because Artemis dying is so sudden. And even the first time through, I was like, this has to be fake. Maybe it's not fake. I don't even know. And I just couldn't even process that.
Yeah.
But the scene of everyone in the cave in different groups and in different places in that just crying because they have lost one of their best friends is just, I need to not cry while we record, is just so awful. And
let's dive into that a little bit. I'm just saying, like, actually that transitions pretty well into our Canary debrief. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Actually, wait, before we go into the Canary debrief, I do want to point out, because I'm going to forget it and it doesn't fit anywhere else. I love Dick Grayson's line of "we have a history." I love it. It amuses me way too much. I love it because we barely get to see them interact this season.
I like that. I don't particularly care for Wally's "you're a dog," like dog comment. But other than that, Dick was appropriate. No kissing and telling and doing what he's supposed to do. Yeah. That's all he needs to say.
Y'all don't need to know. And Greg Wiseman's addition of "she trusts him."
Yeah, right.
Like, I have questions. What is their current relationship status? Please inform me.
You get nothing.
I need answers.
All right. Canary debrief.
Stick around. Class is in session.
So for the Canary debrief today, we are talking a bit about Artemis's death fake out and how they accomplish that in this narrative. Because if you're going to have something happen and then reveal to your audience that it was all a ruse, it was all fake, it was all whatever it was, if it didn't happen the way the reader or viewer thought it did, you need to lay the groundwork for that. Nightwing doesn't just go, "Artemis is alive, we faked the whole thing." Because then that leaves the entire audience going, wait, what, how, what? Instead, we're shown exactly how it went down, and it's the exact same scene we saw earlier, but from a different perspective. It's the same shot of Calder stabbing Artemis through the chest, but from the other side, so we can see how that works. It's the same shot of Nightwing catching her and holding her, but this time we can see that he crushes a blood pack on her chest. It's the exact same scene with certain things heightened and certain things shot from different angles so that we see that they didn't add anything retroactively. They just laid the groundwork beforehand and then told us afterwards.
Yeah. And we're lucky that we got that in the same episode. But especially if you're going to do something that's down the line, like, okay, in episode 3 or 4 of 20 something episodes in a season, we're going to lay something. And then we're going to tell you later on how that wasn't what you thought it was. You need to do it right. Don't make it feel like a retcon. Know what you're doing ahead of time. You know, like Crispin had said, be a conscious creator. Set things up and knock them down, right? They set it up and they knocked it down. It was still emotional, but not because, oh, we got tricked because Artemis is really alive, you know, kind of a thing. But it's emotional because you see the consequences for everyone else on the team, right?
Yes.
And normally I'd have an issue with the not telling people thing, but the team is huge now. There's a lot of people. It's not like there's just a couple of people, right? And even when there was a couple of people, like when Calder didn't tell them about the mole, there was still good reasons for doing that, right? In this one, like, yeah, I guess he could have told McGann. They could have told some other people, but I can understand keeping it close to the chest. And it's kind of like you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, right?
Absolutely. Though I personally feel like you should have let the original members of the team in on it, but that's just me because we see how that goes down later with things with that. But like, Superboy, McGann, senior members of the team that should maybe have access to this kind of information, just to be safe, you know.
So here's the thing. Who didn't know? Only McGann, right? From the original team?
Flash and Superboy. Knew. Connor doesn't know.
Connor and McGann, you're right.
They purposefully trick Connor because they have Artemis take something that'll slow her heartbeat so that Connor can't hear it.
Yeah. And that's interesting to me because they could have let them in. I mean, it certainly sets up the Miss Martian thing that we won't talk about that happens later. But is there a good reason for them not to tell at least Superboy and McGann? That's definitely a conversation to be had, I think. But I think you make some great points. Again, focusing back on the actual fake out itself, everything was thought of. If there was a reason specifically why they didn't think Superboy should know, they cover those bases. Superboy can hear her heartbeat. So she takes something to slow her heartbeat down. Like they address all of those things, right?
And even that shot of her biting down on whatever it is, because they don't feel the need to tell us exactly how she does this. We just need to know that she does. Yes. That shot is even in the first scene, that exact same shot. It's just that you think it's her gasping and then closing her mouth, when in reality it's her biting down on a pill to slow her heartbeat.
Right. And I agree. So think ahead of time, be a conscious creator as much as possible. Think ahead of time on what you're going to do long term and make sure to do your edits right and set things up to knock them down. All right. Yeah. Let's get into crashing the mode though. We're dodging around a few things here. Let's crash the mode.
Tell us something we don't know yet.
Sorry, BB. We can't risk altering the time stream. We do that, we're all feeling the mode.
Yes. Because what could go wrong? Everything. Everything could go wrong. Literally everything. Artemis, dear God, why?
I like the fact that they got Calder backup.
Yes.
I like the fact that they got backup for him. I like that they revisit the question of whether or not he's a traitor later on when he blows up Mount Justice. I like that Wally's worried about Artemis as well. Yeah. Like maybe this could be a problem, right, in the future. Go ahead. You look like you have something to say.
Just all of that. Everything that they could possibly set up for in this episode, they deliver on later, and it is intense. Also, even within the episode, Crashing the Mode, the fact that they consistently have Artemis referencing death is so stressful as a little mini crashing the mode within the episode is so stressful after that first thing. And at the same time, it feels almost like it could be cheap if it was her actual death when you find out that it's like, no, she faked her death. Of course she's thinking about death this whole time. It's not just let's be heavy handed. It's her being like, nah, I'm kind of pretending to die today. That's on my mind a little bit. So that's mini crashing the mode, just throwing that out there. But yeah, I feel like we should have learned from Failsafe that you don't kill Artemis in front of McGann and think bad things won't happen. Like, we've been here before, guys.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. That's a really interesting point that I had not thought of.
Artemis's death does not do good things for McGann's psyche. Ever. We know this. Make better choices, Nightwing.
You had something you were going to say about Miss Martian and crashing the mode, too.
Right. Because you were asking if she ever goes back to Mars or not. In the last episode of the season, at the very end, as they're all going out to do all of their things and Nightwing leaves to go do his thing, Calder is giving everyone missions. And if it's like the thing before they before Bereft, where Batman starts explaining stuff and it kind of fades out. But if you listen, you hear Calder say one of the squads is Miss Martian, Superboy, Beast Boy. You guys are going to Mars to do whatever. And I can't remember what it is, but he does say we need the three of you to go to Mars. And so they have the ability to, and they are at some point after season two going to send her there. I would love to see that in season three of Miss Martian just goes back home, because that would be incredibly interesting. But yeah, it's referenced later.
I got to go back and listen to that again. I don't remember that.
I only know that because I saw it pointed out online. I didn't catch it the first few times through. I saw it pointed out online. I was like, oh my God, it's great.
By the time this airs, we'll have aired our actual play podcast as well. I am...
5 minutes and 35 seconds of audio redacted.
Well, that was a bit deep dive crashing the mode. And again, because in the comics, Martian Manhunter is supposedly the last member of his race or his species on Mars. And in some cases, because of a genocide performed by the white Martians, you know, it's just different takes on his origins are so funky. I'm wondering if they're so, if they procreate so quickly and there's that many of them and they're this superpowered, why haven't they just taken over everything? Like, why haven't they come to Earth and, you know, done something? Why is there not more, if they have Martian, if they have bioships that can travel between planets with no problem, why isn't there more communication with Mars? That makes it an interesting thought
they
process.
They are benevolent, terrifying demigods.
Balls of sunshine, yeah?
No, that's only Ms. Martian.
Oh, I see. All right, great. All right, well, let's move on to some fan service then. We have kind of a really cool, unique one this week. Go for it, Em.
I've admired your stance on animal rights for years.
We do. We have an awesome piece called Young Justice by the Numbers, which is this crazy cool infographic created by Tigatog on Tumblr that I think I read somewhere is two people with one account. It is an insane infographic with these super interesting statistics and breakdowns for both seasons of the show, cataloging how many times catchphrases are said, how many times certain attacks are used. Every single nickname for Kid Flash is on there somewhere, and that's a fun one. There's just so many amazing statistics on there that you never knew you needed to know until you read it. And you can find it on Tumblr. We'll have the link down in the show notes. I think I have also reblogged that to the YJ Files Tumblr. So if you follow us over there, if you're one of like the 15 people who follows us over there, you have seen it. But if you haven't, go check it out. It is incredible. Never been more entertained by a graph.
It even includes a page called the Dictionary that has all of Dick Grayson's things like turbed, whelmed, user unfriendly, aster, etc., etc. Yeah, it's pretty awesome. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes. So pop over there and check that out. And with that, I think we can wrap up this mission and head out of the cave. Of course, the best way to support the show is with a 5-star review on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice.
Also, please continue to hashtag KeepBingingYJ and hashtag BuyYJComics on Comixology. You can also now use hashtag YoungJusticeOutsiders when talking about Season 3. And if you want to help us get more episodes, more Secret Origins, actual play podcasts, and way more than all of that, please consider supporting us through Patreon. For just a few dollars a month, you can help us do even more with the show while getting some great rewards for yourself. And remember,
stay whelmed, everyone.
You've been listening to Whelmed, the Young Justice Files podcast. Our hosts are Rich Howard and Emily Bouza. Our editor and producer is Neil Powell. Our theme was composed by Emily Mio. Our logo was created by Kevin Bates. Whelmed is a fan-made podcast and is not officially affiliated with DC Comics, DC Entertainment, Warner Brothers Animation, and any other owners of Young Justice or its related source material. As such, these companies have sole ownership of all symbols, images, names, logos, and proprietary material related to Young Justice. Original content of this podcast is ours under Creative Commons. Thanks for listening, and stay Whelmed.